Hello and welcome to this episode of Employment Law Matters. In this episode, we're talking about conduct dismissals. You'll learn how to deal with misconduct that takes place outside of the workplace, the interaction between misconduct dismissals and dismissals for some other substantial reason, managing conduct issues where the employee suffers from poor mental health, and much more. This is Season 6, Episode 8. It's the 16th of May, 2023. I'm Barrister Daniel Barnett, a member of Outer Temple Chambers, presenter of The Legal Hour on LBC Radio, and founder of the HR Inner Circle. In this season, I'm picking my favourite dozen episodes from the series of 30 employment law webinars I ran in 2021. I've not only picked my favourite dozen episodes, but I've selected the best half dozen questions and answers from each of those episodes for you. As I said, this week we're looking at conduct dismissals. I'm playing extracts from a webinar I did with Imogen Egan on that subject. But before we get to that, I want to talk briefly to the HR professionals listening today. If that's you, and you have a difficult employment relations issue you're dealing with, you can get answers super quick from the extensive resource library in the HR Inner Circle, hrinnercircle.co.uk. It takes just two clicks and a quick keyword search using our rapid results search tool. You'll instantly find precisely where your topic is covered in our extensive back catalogue of monthly magazines and audio seminars. In under 30 seconds, you can find exactly what you're after. It's that quick and easy. And if you need a specific legal insight, then you can pose your question live to an expert employment lawyer in our fortnightly Q&A sessions. It'll either be me, Daniel Barnett, or one of my prominent colleagues. In fact, Darren Newman, who you heard on this podcast last week, crops up regularly, as does Imogen Egan, who you're about to hear from in just a second. You'll get your answer immediately from us without having to pay any legal costs. And if you can't wait, you can find where it's been answered before, because we have answered pretty much everything before, with a quick search of previous Q&A sessions. Our clever index system means you can find any question and in a single click get straight to the recorded answer. But perhaps you need to deep dive and explore the different options open to you to solve a particularly tricky problem. Then you can join one of our monthly HR huddles. That's where you can run your specific situation past other HR professionals. They'll offer their insights, share their experience, and work with you to find a solution that works for you. You'll find all this in one convenient place, the HR Inner Circle. Have a look. Have a look. www.hrinnercircle.co.uk for more information. Let's turn now to Imogen Egan, who you'll hear today answering questions on conduct dismissals. Imogen is a barrister at Outer Temple Chambers with me. She specialises in employment law as well as health and personal injury work. She came to the bar following an extended pupillage scheme with the Free Representation Unit. When not in tribunal, Imogen tells me that she loves to knit.
Welcome to Employment Law Matters with Barrister Daniel Barnett.
A question that crops up from time to time is what happens if somebody has committed an act of misconduct outside of work, but not in the actual workplace. Can an employer fairly dismiss an employee for an act against another employee, which takes place outside work, if the police don't press charges due to a lack of evidence?
I think the answer is yes, but as with most of these questions, it's going to be fact specific. So the starting point, the basic principle in the ACAS code at paragraph 30 is that if an employee is charged with, well, in this case, we know charges have been dropped or not pursued, or convicted of a criminal offence, that isn't normally in itself a reason for disciplinary action. You've got to give consideration to what effect the charge or conviction, or in this case, the incident, has on the employee's suitability to do the job and their relationship with their employer, work colleagues and customers. You've got to consider the nature of the offence or the incident, So was it violent conduct? Was it dishonest? The nature of their work? Do they work in a, thanks Daniel, do they work in a position of trust or with vulnerable service users, for example? The extent to which their work involves contact with other employees or the general public, and the status of the employee. So are they a public figure or particularly senior in the organisation? Then once you've assessed that and decided that you are going to institute formal proceedings, so you've got to remember still, you've got to have a fair investigation. You've got to give them an opportunity to respond to the allegations against them at a disciplinary hearing. In this case, I think the fact that the police haven't decided to take it any further due to lack of evidence isn't determinative. It's important not to get too hung up on that, because of course the standard of proof required is different in criminal proceedings and in workplace or employment law matters. So an employer only has to have a genuine belief in misconduct based on reasonable grounds following a reasonable investigation, rather than proof beyond reasonable doubt, which is required in criminal proceedings. And I think this is in some ways analogous to the scenario where an employee is charged but acquitted of an offence. And we know from case law that disciplinary proceedings can properly be pursued even where an employee has been acquitted of a criminal offence. That's the case of Saeed and Greater London Council. I won't give all the citations. We can add those later, I'm sure, Daniel. So I think really it's the same kind of scenario here. If it's going to impact their work, their relationship with the employer, then it may be relevant for disciplinary investigation. Another angle is, in this case, it's involving a fellow employee. So you've got to consider their working relationship, even if there's not provable misconduct. Has their relationship broken down to such an extent you can't move this employee to another area of work? Does it mean that then there's potential some other substantial reason dismissal if there's a breakdown in the relationship? I think possibly. So yes, overall, but always investigate properly.
Let's move to the other end of the spectrum, the director level conduct issue. Is a failure by a director to disclose a conflict of interest an act of gross misconduct which can result in their service agreement or their employment contract being terminated without notice?
Again, it's a matter of specific facts. So I think potentially, yes. The director's statutory duties are set out under Section 175 of the Companies Act 2006, and that requires them to disclose any conflict of interest. Assuming that there are no express terms in the contract on this issue, a serious failure might be something which breaches the implied term of fidelity in their employment contract. Thank you, Daniel. Or their fiduciary duty, and as such, it could amount to gross misconduct. The duty of fidelity, which we're all familiar with, is as described by Lord Wolfe in Attorney General and Blake, which is that the employee must act in good faith. He must not make a profit out of his trust. He must not place himself in a position where his duty and his interest may conflict. And he may not act for his own benefit or the benefit of a third party without the informed consent of his employer. Of course, the fiduciary duty is a duty that a director owes, so over and above a normal employee, to the business to act in the best interests of the business. However, as I said, it's going to be fact specific. The employer might want to consider how serious the conflict of interest is, whether the director ought reasonably to have known that it would be a problem when assessing the seriousness of the director's failure to disclose the conflict. As ever, are there any other mitigating factors? Simply don't resort to dismissal as a knee-jerk reaction.
First question comes from Sue Apps. Sue says, can you please talk about the type of circumstances in which multiple allegations of different misconduct under one disciplinary process could provide grounds for summary dismissal, even though each allegation taken alone wouldn't amount to gross misconduct? So really, this is a question about totting up, like for speeding fines or penalty points. Can lots and lots of minor incidents tot up to justify dismissal if there haven't been previous warnings?
I can see that can happen. I think it's important to think about the whole picture and the seriousness overall. Hopefully this is something that you'll have set out in your disciplinary policy so that employees are aware that this is a possibility, and at each stage they ought to be warned that dismissal is a possibility as you're investigating. The types of circumstances, I'm struggling to think of specific examples where it might happen, but perhaps something which is set out as misconduct in the disciplinary policy, so use of a mobile phone, but not gross misconduct. If you're talking then about multiple incidents back to back of using a mobile phone at work, then perhaps it could be. But I struggle to see a scenario where you've got all of these incidents of misconduct, not gross misconduct, and you've not had an opportunity to give them a warning after each one, so that they're all coming together as part of the same investigation. And Daniel, have you got any experience?
Yeah, no, I mean, as a matter of theory, of course, there might be a situation where something cumulatively might make it within the range of reasonable responses to dismiss, which is the statutory test. But I'm struggling, like you, to think of anything. So even if you had an employee who was discovered to have used some stamps for personal use, misused mobile phones, been rude to a colleague, failed to clock in properly on one occasion, even if you've got lots and lots of little things, I just don't think a tribunal would say that once someone's accrued 2 years' employment, you can get rid of them the first time you catch them doing that.
No, I think David Mackay said in the chat box, what if they will happen within a couple of days. Again, I think if this is the first opportunity, it's the same offence repeated multiple times before you've been able to give them a warning, and it's not something that on its own would normally be gross misconduct, then I don't think that would be enough. I think give them a warning, keep a record of it, and then come back to it.
Radar is a specialist commercial and litigation law firm dedicated to helping businesses navigate their risk, including employment issues. Radar's legal expertise and innovative digital tools focus on educating businesses before problems happen. Book your free 30-minute employment and HR consultation today, or subscribe to their monthly newsletter at Radar, that's RRADAR, radar.com/employment. Please talk us through the interrelationship between misconduct dismissals and some other substantial dismissals based on breakdown of trust and confidence, and when it would be appropriate to plead both, because arguably in almost all gross misconduct dismissals, there will have been a breakdown in trust and confidence.
I think generally it's better to keep your pleadings as clean and concise as possible. So I know that there is sort of a habit in some quarters of pleading absolutely everything you can and then leaving it to the barrister to narrow it down when they get to tribunal. And that, I think, annoys employment judges. So it's not something I'd recommend. If it's really clear that it's a misconduct issue, it's something that is set out in your disciplinary policy and you've gone through the disciplinary process, then I wouldn't plead it as a some other substantial reason dismissal. I think where that's more relevant is where you can't show that there is necessarily misconduct on the part of the employee, but circumstances mean that the relationship has otherwise broken down. That's, I think, when it's more appropriate to plead some other substantial reason. But as a rule, try and keep it concise and stick to one if you can.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree. There was some case law, it was years ago now, Imogen, and it was Mr. Justice Burton when he was president, and he said, everything can be pleaded in the sense that trust and confidence is broken down because someone's committed an act of misconduct, because someone's not been at work for a long, long time, because. And he said, just don't waste time saying the relationship's always broken down. That just goes with the flow. I'd avoid pleading SOSR unless you have to. The principal reason for dismissal is conduct, and that's the end of it. Hayley asks, this is a tough question. What's the best approach in managing misconduct, poor behaviour, when mental health issues are cited as the reason?
Oh, that is a good question, Hayley. Thank you. I suppose it's important to remember that most employers aren't going to be health professionals or mental health professionals, so you need to seek expert advice You need to get the employee's permission to refer them to occupational health and get a report there. And hopefully you'll have a good occupational health provider and they'll answer your questions when you say the employee has explained that, for example, their depression and anxiety has caused them to have these outbursts in the workplace and to use bad language to their manager. Can you explain whether or not that might be a possibility and how we can best support them? I think once you've done that and you've got evidence which you're reasonably comfortable is sufficiently thorough, and you put in place measures to support the employee, and then the conduct doesn't improve, then you can look at escalating it to the next stage. But I think you're right to be careful that when that reason is given, you need to make sure that you're satisfying your obligations to your employee who's potentially in a difficult place with mental health issues.
Thank you. Amaya Corcuera, I'm sorry, Amaya, I'm almost certainly mispronouncing your name, asks, what's your advice, Imogen Egan, on taking into account expired warnings or similar conduct that hasn't led to a formal warning in a disciplinary process?
Okay, so I think generally the principle is that it's unreasonable to rely upon an expired warning in order to dismiss for an offence which wouldn't be gross misconduct normally. But I think this case law, and I'm checking my notes, I think it's the case of Airbus UK Limited and Webb from 2008, which says that in very limited circumstances, an expired warning can be taken into account when deciding whether or not to afford leniency as to sanction. So I think that's the stage at which you could take it into account, but only in limited circumstances. Generally, if it's expired, it's not going to be relevant.
Natalie White asks, how wide is the discretion for employers in deciding whether misconduct is gross misconduct? And how is an employer expected to justify that in an employment tribunal?
I think it is relatively wide. And of course, it's going to be down to the manager's discretion, the manager who's dealing with it at disciplinary stage. Hopefully, it will be the kind of conduct that you can see from your disciplinary policy is likely to be something that's gross misconduct. I don't think there's unfettered discretion. So if it's something which most reasonable people applying common sense wouldn't think was gross misconduct, then you're going to have a difficult time justifying it to the tribunal. The best way to justify it is to have a really clear disciplinary policy, setting out potential examples, and I suppose to have a clear record of what's happened in similar cases in the past, so how you've treated them, how it impacts the business, that sort of thing. Why this misconduct in particular is so fundamental that it goes to the heart of the employment relationship.
Anonymous attendee, is an employee still an employee after they've been dismissed and while they're awaiting an appeal?
No, I don't think so. I think the contract has been terminated. It's come to an end unless they're reinstated on appeal, in which case I suppose retrospectively, then they'll have back pay and all sorts. But no, not an employee if they've been dismissed and not as yet reinstated.
Yeah. And the way that courts and tribunals deal with reinstatement, they say that the appeal, successful appeal, effectively vanishes the dismissal. Which I've never been able to get my head around that, because, of course, what happened to covenants and fiduciary duties during the intermediary period? Did they exist or didn't they exist? I think that's yet to be solved by the courts properly. But you're absolutely right. They are not employees until an appeal is heard and allowed. Breeden Consulting provides small and medium businesses with the breadth of HR support usually enjoyed by large corporates. So if you want practical and commercially focused HR support, or if you're an HR professional looking for an opportunity to capitalise on your experience by joining a great team, visit www.breedenconsulting, that's B-R-E-E-D-O-N, breedenconsulting.co.uk. Sonia Jane asks, how much weight should be given to the remorsefulness or lack of remorse of an employee during disciplinary action?
Right. I think you take this into account after you've assessed the seriousness of the conduct and you're looking at possible sanction. That's my view. I don't think it necessarily affects whether or not it's misconduct or gross misconduct. It's going to vary from employer to employer, really, and from manager to manager, because it's something that's subjective. But in practice, I think it is something that, that weighs quite heavily with employers, because if you're looking at to what extent can the employment relationship continue, how can we trust this employee in the future if they are remorseful and they say, oh, I wouldn't do it this way next time, then you're more likely to be able to say, well, I could trust them to come back to the workplace. I might give them a final written warning for this gross misconduct rather than dismissal, and keep that on their file in case they do it again.
Les Veronofsky asks, if an employer dismisses without holding an appeal where an appeal was requested, but then offers an appeal after it gets the ET1, can that appeal be taken into account when deciding the reasonableness of the dismissal? I assume implicit in Les's question is that a very long time gap has passed between when the appeal should have taken place and the ET1 has been lodged.
I think it's going to be potentially embarrassing for the advocate or for the respondent turning up at tribunal, having to explain A, the initial refusal, and B, why they've suddenly been prompted out of the goodness of their heart to offer this appeal on receipt of an ET1. But I don't see why it couldn't. So if you can show that the person dealing with the appeal has done a full rehearing, for example, and that they are someone who had their mind open, they're not previously involved, and that reinstatement was a real possibility, then I think you could rely on it. It's going to be really difficult to show that, because you know the motivation at this stage is to try and stymie the claim against them rather than because they actually want to comply with their obligations. But I think it could be, in theory, perhaps if you employed someone external to hear it, maybe, rather than someone who was internal, it might have more force. Have you ever come across such a case, Daniel? I don't think I've had one like that.
No, I haven't, but I agree 100% with what you're saying. I think that's bang on. JP Choi, I think this is quite almost a one-word answer. If there are several allegations of misconduct which overall result in dismissal, would you recommend spitting out and reaching an individual conclusion on each allegation as well as an overall sanction?
Yes.
Yes.
you need to be able to show that you've got a genuine belief in the misconduct on each point, and that you have reasonable grounds for coming to that genuine belief, and that each of them has been investigated. So what evidence do you have if you were to get to tribunal?
What about saying in respect of each allegation, Imogen Egan, if this was an isolated, if this was the only thing, I would have dismissed you for this, or I would not have dismissed you for this allegation?
I think that can only be helpful, really, can't it? Because if there's going to be a challenge, whether it's an appeal or employment tribunal claim, a challenge where some of them are upheld but not others, so you didn't have a genuine belief or it wasn't formed on reasonable grounds on these five, but on this one it was, and this one on its own would have been sufficient to justify dismissal, and you've explained how and why it would be, perhaps with reference to your disciplinary policy, then, I mean, that sort of stymies the claim, really, doesn't it? So, yes.
Yeah, agreed. That was Imogen Egan from Outer Temple Chambers. Imogen, thank you so much. Join me next Tuesday, the 23rd of May, 2023, when I'll be bringing you highlights from my webinar with Tom Croxford, King's Counsel of Blackstone Chambers, in which he answers questions on whistleblowing. And remember, if you're an HR professional, do have a look at www.hrinnercircle.co.uk, the UK's leading community for smart, ambitious HR professionals. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Daniel Barnett. Stay safe.
Any information on this podcast is for general guidance only. Always seek legal advice. Please see full terms at www.danielbarnett.co.uk/podcast-terms.